Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, January the 30th, 2019. We begin with the news section. Old money. In Durham, African Americans get fewer mortgages than whites, perpetuating the wealth gap. For anyone who follows Durham politics, most of the contents of a new report on impediments to fair housing in Durham County will be unsurprising. Housing is expensive. It's getting more expensive, and there isn't enough of it. But on page 14 of the report, which the county is required to complete on a regular basis in order to be eligible for federal community development block grants, is a detail that doesn't always make it into the conversations about the Bull City's housing landscape. African Americans apply for home loans less often and are awarded less money than white borrowers. According to the report compiled by the civil and environmental engineering firm Withers and Ravenal, as the county seeks $750,000 in grants for neighborhood revitalization, white people, who make up about half of the county's population, applied for 49% of mortgages from 2014 to 2017 and received 61% of the approved funds. African Americans, on the other hand, make up about 37% of the population. They submitted a quarter of loan applications and got just 20% of approved funding. The report looks at Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data for the first mortgage on a 1-to-4-unit home, including manufactured homes. Emily Emmons, the consultant who worked on the report, says that, according to the HMDA data, Latino residents in Durham County are seeking and receiving mortgages on par with their 13% share of the population, though she cautions that HMDA data is sometimes incomplete. These lending disparities aren't unique to the Durham area, says Kelly Tarno, North Carolina Policy Director for the Center for Responsible Lending. It's unfortunately not a surprising report, because it really reflects the national trends that we see when we analyze the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data. It increasingly shows that consumers of color and low-wealth families still lack access to the mortgage market. This can have an effect not only on prospective homeowners, but also renters. If people can't buy homes, they rent, adding to demand for an already limited housing supply and driving up prices. According to the report, the median gross rent in Durham County rose from $797 in 2010 to $925 in 2016, and nearly half of the county's 25,614 renter households were cost-burdened, meaning they spent more than 30% of their incomes on housing costs. To address these disparities, the report recommends additional outreach to both lenders and potential borrowers, as well as the use of publicly backed mortgage programs offered by federal agencies. The report doesn't get into why Durham applicants were denied for loans. However, at the state and national levels, borrowers of color are less likely to be approved for mortgage credits, regardless of factors like income and credit score. According to the state's analysis of impediments to fair housing, which was completed in 2015, an applicant's credit history and debt-to-income ratio were frequent reasons for being denied home loans from 2004 through 2013. So it is no surprise that denial rates tended to fall as the income of the applicant rose. The application analysis also reads, however, disparities in loan denial rates by sex, race, and ethnicity tended to present persist even when income was taken into account. Tourneau says these patterns are partly due to the way banks responded to the 2008 mortgage crisis. Although very important consumer protections were put in place as a result of the mortgage crisis, unfortunately, there's also been a restriction of access to credit for borrowers of color. Rather than the market really opening up for access to credit, allowing more borrowers to access the market, we're seeing a really high credit score requirement and a debt-to-income ratio requirement that actually is higher than pre-crisis levels. That really locks people out of the market, and that's particularly detrimental because it exasperates the racial wealth gap that we see. The stage was set for these disparities long before that, however, through policies like redlining, which is where banks refuse to give loans to non-white neighborhoods, effectively labeling them undesirable and destroying their property values. Though redlining became illegal half a century ago, the practice is still primarily a primary contributor to the country's persistent wealth gap. White Americans have nearly 10 times the wealth of African Americans and 8 times the wealth of Hispanic Americans. We know home ownership is really the number one way people can build family wealth and pass that wealth on to the next generation. So if you lack wealth and as a result can't get a mortgage, and as a result of not being able to get a mortgage can't build wealth, you can see how this cycle continues to perpetuate, particularly for borrowers of color. The next news article, blind spots. Durham gave a security company a multi-million dollar parking deck contract, then learned, from us, about its troubling history. After the Indy first brought to light allegations of harassment and discrimination against Allied Universal Security Services, Durham wants answers from the company it just awarded a $2.7 million contract to provide security for 5 downtown parking garages. City staffers and elected officials say they were unaware of the lawsuits and criminal cases involving Allied when the council unanimously approved the contract in a work session on Thursday. The Indy first reported on the company's troubling history of litigation on Thursday evening. On Friday, city officials sent the company a letter asking for specifics and how each case was resolved. Thomas Leathers, the city's chief parking administrator, sent the letter, which says the complaints are of great concern. The city of Durham values the fair and equitable treatment of all people, including employees, contractors, residents, visitors, stakeholders, etc., Leathers wrote. The city takes all complaints of this nature very seriously and will investigate fully and fairly. Typically, the council doesn't take action during work sessions, but the Allied deal carried a sense of urgency because the previous contract for parking deck security expired December 31st. In the past, the city had contracted with Parking Management Company, which in turn hired guards. But it's now bringing management of the 5 garages in-house. During the lapse, city spokeswoman Beverly Thompson confirms the decks are not staffed by security guards, though they were monitored more frequently by police. In the search for a contractor, the city's transportation department released a request for proposals, and 6 companies responded. Allied offered the cheapest price, Thompson says. Throughout the process, the transportation department worked with the company's local division and was unaware of complaints brought in other cities. Now that we know, it's all of our responsibility to look at it, Major Steve Shule told the Indy after Thursday's vote. It's our expectation that our administration will bring us contracts we want to approve, and usually they do a good job. We have to take a look at whether this one is an exception. This contract was approved the same week that the council created a workers' rights commission, which will advise the city on how to improve working conditions. Labor organizers hope the commission will help protect workers from low wages, discrimination, and abusive work environments. In other words, the kind of abuses that Allied is accused of. One incident involves a 2018 religious discrimination case, since settled, in which a Muslim security guard was fired after seeking a religious exemption to the company's grooming policies. Another suit was brought by Allied employees in a New York City airport who said they were harassed and pressured by a supervisor for sex. The alleged abuse, detailed in an episode of This American Life, included supervisors denying female guards bathroom breaks for 10 or 12 hours at a time. Last month, two Allied employees pleaded guilty to beating a black man at a Denver transit station, which employees had tried to cover up. Separately, Allied employees described to the Boston Globe a culture of harassing homeless people after a video surfaced in December of 2016 of a guard beating a homeless man in Boston. Steve Meritus, organizing director with the Law Enforcement Officers Security Union, which represents police and security professionals in the Northeast, says Allied is notoriously bad for labor. They've been buying up companies left and right to suppress wages, Meritus said. If the company wasn't paying guards $15 an hour, Allied never would. They'll pay their guys whatever they can get away with. Allied is now the largest security provider in the nation, with more than 200,000 employees at 42,000 client sites, including Duke University. An Allied supervisor at Duke did not respond to a request for comment. While we are unable to comment on pending litigation, Allied Universal is committed to equal and fair employee and maintain strict policies against discrimination and harassment. That was a statement the company made in an email to the Indy. The city wants to know how serious Allied is about these values. In its letter, the city asked the company for examples of actions aimed at mitigating harassment and discrimination. The city specifically took interest in supervisor training programs and changes in grooming policies. I wasn't aware of the allegations prior to the vote, and I'm glad they've been brought to our attention, says City Councilmember Jillian Johnson. We've asked staff to look into the issue more, and I'm most interested in how these issues were handled by the company once they came to light. Shule says the contract didn't initially raise red flags. Typical council conversations about prospective contracts focus on workforce diversity and pay, and Allied met or exceeded the city's goals on both fronts. We have certain mechanisms to make it really easy to test for things we care about, Shule said. The other stuff, you have to hear about. Council member Charlie Reese suspects the company's potential issues weren't flagged because the contract and its related materials mostly refer to University Protective Services, a division of Universal Services of America, the company that Allied Barton Security Services merged with in 2016 to form Allied Universal. Leathers has asked Allied to respond to the city's questions no later than January 3rd, and Shule asked staff to update the council at its February 4th meeting. Of course, we don't want anything like what happened to those other sites to happen here, Johnson said. I think we need to determine whether these incidences are the result of a few bad actors or if there's a culture within the company that encourages or enables harmful behavior by staff. The next news article, playing catch-up. Wake's new housing affordability department hopes to add hundreds of units a year to curb its snowballing crisis. It won't be enough. Everyone in Wake County government acknowledges the affordable housing crisis. It's impossible to ignore. About 4% of county residents are considered extremely cost-burdened, meaning they pay more than half their incomes in rent. Another 5% pay between 30 and 50% of their incomes. To meet its current housing needs, officials say, Wake must fill a gap of 56,000 affordable units. If trends continue, that deficit will rise to 150,000 units by 2035, and that's just to maintain the existing gap. It's not even counting coming close to that. Last year, the county committed to building 192 new affordable units, providing permanent vouchers to more than 300 families, and supporting the rehabilitation of 217 affordable units. Combined with projects approved by the county's 12 municipalities, developments begun in 2018 will eventually yield 1,030 affordable units throughout Wake County. In 2019, the county's new housing authority affordability department funded with a property tax hike that would generate $15 million a year, hopes to build at least 500 affordable units itself. Raleigh and other municipalities should add more, but the total still won't approach 6,000. We are not going to build our way out of an affordable housing crisis, says Commissioner Pat Calabria. Government-supported housing alone will not solve our problem. The county can't just throw that $15 million at construction, says Lorena McDowell, who oversees the three-month-old housing affordability department. Instead, it's trying to stretch its dollars through private sector partnerships and by pursuing federal low-income tax credits. But that's a competitive and onerous process. Take the 72-unit Zebulon Green project, whose total cost is $11 million. Because of tax credits and private partnership, the county is only paying $1 million, or $13,889 per unit. Without that assistance, each unit would cost the county more than 10 times that. Similarly, the county is only paying $2.5 million for a $22.5 million project in Raleigh called Beacon Ridge. But the trade-off is that things move slowly and don't always come through. Between the two projects, fewer than half of the 440 units for which the county sought tax credits to build last year were approved. For this year, the new department has $7 million in available tax credits and has already received applications from developers to build 704 new units. Not all of them will be approved, but even if they were, that still trails the number of existing units the county loses every year, somewhere between 800 and 1,300, McDowell says, and therein lies the problem. What's more, a key piece to the puzzle is out of the county's control. The affordable housing plan Wake County unveiled last year included a call for municipalities to increase density, allowing more housing to be built in an effort to keep costs in check and prevent the housing gap from spiraling. But the county's largest municipality doesn't seem to be heeding its advice. This is according to the commissioner, Sig Hutchinson. The Raleigh City Council is heading in the wrong direction, and something needs to change, Hutchinson said. Either they need to change the policy or change the council. A majority on the council has prioritized preserving neighborhoods over increasing density in ways big and small, from proposing strict regulations on accessory dwelling units to approving overlay districts that prevent new construction, essentially freezing neighborhoods in time. but Councilmember Kay Crowder scoffed at Hutchinson's characterizations. The city is ahead of the county on affordable housing, she said. In 2016, a year before the county followed suit, the city council raised property taxes to generate about $6 million a year for affordable housing. And she argues that overlay districts are effective a way for neighbors to self-regulate. I believe as a democracy, citizens should always have a choice about what happens in their neighborhoods, Crowder said. In the future, who knows what will happen when the city grows denser? But right now, it's an opportunity to continue to have people decide how they'd like their neighborhoods maintained. Wake County commissioners say they want to work with Raleigh and other local governments this year to increase density, which includes adding things like ADUs, but also so-called missing middle housing, things like duplexes and triplexes. The lack of supply has created high demand, Hutchinson said, and that's driven up pricing faster than wages can keep up. The only way out of the crisis, he argues, is to let developers take the reins. Let developers build denser, taller housing projects that are currently prohibited by many zoning regulations, and constructing affordable developments along transit corridors to ease the cost of a daily commute for cash-strapped families. Calabria said he's proud of what the county's done, but more is needed, and soon. What we have been able to accomplish by many measures is superlative. But there's no doubt we have more to do, he said. It's critical that we do what we need to do to avoid becoming San Francisco in 15 years. The next article from the Soapboxer, the new boss. Donald Trump may believe he's his own hype, but the shutdown proved that Nancy Pelosi isn't playing against the varsity. If Donald Trump were a better politician, all of this could have been avoided. I'm not speaking of his administration's breathtaking incompetence or the president's absurd inability to grasp even the basic points of actual governance so amply demonstrated over the last 2 years. Rather, I speak of the thing that he so loves to brag about, his own supposed political genius. In Trump's narrative, he won an election that no one else could have, a victory so incredible that its only explanation is his superior instincts and intellect. It's true that his victory over Hillary Clinton was an upset, given the polling and the state of the economy and much of the media's certainty that he would lose. But in hindsight, it's also true that he got extraordinarily lucky. He nearly won three key Midwestern states by losing the popular vote by 3 million. He faced an almost equally disliked opponent, dogged by the FBI and the media over email server management. And he was aided by a Russian regime allegedly being assisted by officials from his own campaign. Yet, instead of recognizing that he hit an inside straight, Trump believed his own hype, that he was smarter than everyone else, that he had tapped into a reservoir of real American antipathy toward the elites, that people really wanted his brand of simple-minded faux populism, building the wall and banning immigrants and burning coal and isolating ourselves in the name of nationalism. But in office, he's proven spectacularly bad at rallying the public to his banner and moving his agenda forward. Even with Republicans in control of Congress for 2 years, he enacted just one major law, a tax cut for the rich that did little more than exploit the deficit and offer short-term stimulus to an already growing economy. He didn't replace Obamacare. He didn't build the wall. Sure, he rolled back some of President Obama's environmental and civil and labor rights initiatives through executive action, and he pushed through lots of judges, including two Supreme Court justices, largely thanks to Mitch McConnell's undying cynicism. But he failed to notch significant legislative victories or persuade the county that he's doing a good job, even with a good economy. And come November, he'll get his butt kicked. The wall he made a centerpiece of his campaign, that unpredictably brilliant campaign, in his telling, was slipping away, and his base was restive. So he dug in and made a stand, despite an obviously weak hand. No wall, no government funding, he said. And then he got his butt kicked again. The 35-day shutdown was an unqualified disaster. 800,000 federal workers suffered for no reason. The public blamed him, and Democrats held firm. The more Trump made his case to the American people, the more his approval ratings fell. On Thursday, a bill to fund the wall failed in the GOP-led Senate. On Friday morning, so many unpaid air traffic controllers called in sick that airports saw massive delays. On Friday afternoon, McConnell informed Trump that his caucus was cracking. And finally on Friday night, Trump caved, signing a bill to reopen the government for 3 weeks. He got nothing in return. Actually, he got one fig leaf. A committee to negotiate a deal on border security ahead of the next budget deadline on February 15th. On Saturday, fearing a backlash from his base, Ann Coulter had called him a wimp. Trump returned to defiance, declaring that he'd get his wall in 3 weeks, come hell or high water. Except, he won't. And he might be the only one who doesn't realize it. Nancy Pelosi always knew she wasn't playing against the varsity. Now Trump's weakness has been put on full display. Democrats have no reason to give in to his demands. Republicans have no way to force them to do so. If the government shuts down again, they know Trump will get blamed. And if he funds the government without a wall, Trump knows his supporters will smell weakness. Either way, he loses. Trump can beat his chest about another shutdown, but in truth, he doesn't have many options. Maybe Senate Republicans can convince Democrats to fund additional border fencing and border patrol agents, and Trump can claim victory. Or Trump can make good on his threat to declare a national emergency and circumvent Congress to build the wall, which might be a hard sell to a judge considering that he's dithering over declaring an emergency for 2 months, which undercuts the idea that there's an emergency worth declaring. In the meantime, Trump gives Pelosi a perfect excuse to delay something he really could have used this week. With its pomp and circumstance, the State of Union address, originally scheduled for Tuesday, offered Trump a national television audience and a temporary respite from his myriad troubles. Hello, Roger Stone. As well as a chance to, if he played it right, reinsert himself and reset his presidency after his midterm spanking. He'll still give that speech, but on Nancy's terms and on her schedule. Next Tuesday, she'll let him into her house. That power dynamic and Trump's pathological inability to deal with it will be the story of the next 2 years. Pelosi is good at this game, and she's got his number. Trump is bad at it, but his ego won't let him see it. Now a feature article, The Cabin in the Woods. For nearly 40 years, Duke hosted a beloved summer camp for kids with serious illnesses. A new lawsuit accuses the university of covering up the disturbing incident that abruptly shut it down. Every July for nearly 40 years, Duke University offered children and teenagers with chronic illnesses, cancer, asthma, lupus, heart disease, a chance to do a normal kid thing that, for them, had seemed out of reach. They could go to summer camp. Most sleepaway camps couldn't accommodate them. Counselors didn't have the right training. Facilities didn't have the right equipment. So they were forced to miss out on formative experiences that their peers took for granted. In 1979, three Duke employees, a physician, social worker, and play therapist, set out to change that. The university rented a Girl Scouts campground overlooking Kerr Lake in Henderson, about an hour's drive northeast of Durham. Kids between the ages of 7 and 16 who were being treated at Duke University Children's Hospital could spend a week there, free of charge, their stays funded by donations. Camp Kaleidoscope lasted 3 weeks, each week dedicated to a different age group. Duke residents, students, social workers, child life specialists, and other employees served as counselors and staff. More than 1,000 children attended Camp K, as it was known, over the next 38 years, many of them repeat campers. For some, it was their first time away from home. They played sports and learned to swim, did crafts and arts, and were entertained by magicians. By all accounts, Camp K was beloved. And then suddenly, it closed. On July 20, 2017, Duke Medicine Department of Pediatrics Chairwoman Am Reed and Camp Director Julie Panella disclosed the decision in an email to Camp Kaleidoscope families. They said, "This very difficult decision was made following an encounter among several campers last week that required us to take a close look at our operations to ensure that we have appropriate policies and procedures in place that our families expect when they entrust their children to our care. We look forward to returning next year and hope you will join us again to experience the transformative joy of Camp Kaleidoscope." But Camp K didn't return in 2018, and according to internet and database searching, Duke never publicly announced the camp's closure, much less explained the encounter that prompted it to shutter, or how its policies and procedures might have failed the children in its care. Three lawsuits filed in Durham against Duke University and several of its entities, as well as Reed and Panella, two in 2017 that were previously gone unreported, and a third on Friday, aimed to shine an unsettling light on that mystery. According to the lawsuits, in the summer of 2017, five boys between the ages of 7 and 10 who were attending Camp Kaleidoscope were left alone in a cabin for at least an hour on multiple nights. One of them, an 8-year-old son of a Duke respiratory therapist, allegedly repeatedly sexually assaulted some of the others and led his bunkmates to perform sex acts on each other. Duke, the lawsuits charge, colluded and conspired to conceal what took place at Camp Kaleidoscope and engaged in a conspiracy to hide child sexual abuse that took place as a result of their negligence. In a statement on behalf of the university, Reed and Panella, Duke Health spokesman Douglas Stoke declined to comment, citing Duke's commitment to protecting the privacy of minors and their families. But in their responses to the first two lawsuits, Duke's lawyers rejected allegations that the university tried to hide anything. They also denied the sexual assault claims and maintained that the defendants exercised reasonable care and diligence in their respective roles at the camp. The evidence is clear, however, that something disturbing happened at Camp K that summer. Records included in court filings showed that, on July 13, 2017, the five boys were left unsupervised for an unknown amount of time in a cabin. Four of them were then transported from the camp to Duke University Children's Hospital Emergency Department for an evaluation. There, one of them told a psychiatry fellow they had been sucking on each other. Then, a week later, Duke pulled the plug on the camp. Something happened. What that something was, whether it was a sexual assault or something else, whether Duke tried to sweep a scandal caused by its own negligence under the rug, or simply wanted to shield vulnerable children from psychological harm, will likely be the subject of a complex, confounding court battle that is only just beginning. The lawyer representing the families of the three boys suing Duke, Robert Jessup, declined to comment or make his clients available for interviews. Their version of events is laid out in the three lawsuits, the most recent of which is the most detailed. The boys at the center of the case is the boy identified at the center of the case is identified as John Doe, then a 9-year-old with brain cancer. His two bunkmates, whose families sued Duke in 2017, are identified in their respective lawsuits as M.M., then 7, who has a sickle cell anemia, and A.E., then 8, who has visual impairment and unspecified physical disabilities. Court documents indicate that another child who is not part of the lawsuit, referred to as Boy 4, also engaged in sexual activity. According to John Doe's lawsuit, one of these children was HIV positive, and another had oral herpes, though the lawsuit doesn't specify who had what. The lawsuits identify the fifth bunkmate, who was then about a week shy of his 9th birthday, as the instigator, and accuse him of sexually abusing the other boys. According to the Doe lawsuit, he did not have a medical condition. Instead, he was attending the camp because his father, the respiratory therapist, was a camp counselor that week. Court records suggest the boy may have had a tumultuous home life. The Doe lawsuit references a court case in Wake County involving the boy's parents. In a court filing attached to the Doe lawsuit, his mother describes his father as aggressive, says he has serious mental instability that has required hospitalization on at least 3 occasions, and claim that he's threatened suicide on multiple occasions. In 2013, according to court documents, the parents separated, and the father sought custody of the three boys, of whom the instigator is the youngest. The parents reconciled, but the mother then sought a domestic violence protection order against the father, only to drop it a few days later. In December 2015, the father sued the mother's alleged lover in Wake County under North Carolina's Alienation of Affection statute. Finally, in February 2017, 5 months before the incident at Camp K, they divorced. The NDA is not identifying the parents to protect the identity of the child. According to the Doe lawsuit, these five boys were supervised by 2 camp counselors, a Duke psychiatric resident, and a child life specialist. Each night, the lawsuit says, the counselors left the boys alone and unattended for an hour or more. These counselors were leaving these young children alone in the cabin without any adult supervision, while they attended meetings in the staff house at the direction of the camp's leaders. The counselors are not defendants in any of these cases. While state law makes it a misdemeanor to leave a child under 8 locked or otherwise confined in a building without an adult so as to expose the child to danger by fire, there isn't a statute specifying a presumptive age which a child may be left unattended, according to the UNC School of Government. In July 13, 2017, the last night of the camp week, the law says, one of the counselors returned from a staff meeting and found John Doe's bunkmate performing an oral act on one another. The most complete account of this event comes from an email included in court files that Boy Ford's mother sent to Pinella and another Duke employee on July 16, 2017. The mother tacitly acknowledged that young children aren't always reliable narrators, but says, I'm a good read of her son, and I'm really confident he's telling me the truth. According to the mother's email, the counselor reported that she walked in and saw all five boys with their pants down. However, boy four told his mother she was mistaken. The boys had scattered when she entered their cabin, and John Doe, who the law says was present but not participating, was wearing shorts that were two sizes too big, so they might have fallen down. At the time, boy four told his mother John Doe was present and holding the flashlight while the other boys engaged in the activities. This had always happened the previous night, she said. Her son told her that he'd hung out with them both the night because they had been playing games previously and what they were doing, with their pants down, was boring. And I just wanted them to stop so we could start playing games again, like before. According to the Doe lawsuit and the mother's email, the idea for all of this originated with the instigator. But Pinella offered a different explanation to Lindsay Terrell, a pediatrician working at Duke Children's Hospital, the night of July 13, 2017. Four of the boys, all except John Doe, were taken there after the counselor discovered them. According to a note included in court records that a Duke child abuse specialist was sent to read, Pinella told Terrell that the words about the activity had been written on the cabin's wall where children could read it and allegedly got the idea. Pinella called M.M.'s parents that night and A.E.'s guardians the next morning to tell them that the children had been sexually assaulted and potentially exposed to HIV, according to the lawsuits. In its responses, Duke admitted that she called but denied that she had been assaulted and told them about the potential HIV exposure. M.M. said family lawsuit says, began undergoing a rigid prophylactic treatment for HIV/AIDS. But no one informed John Doe's parents or guardians what had happened, his family's lawsuit says, or that his bunkmates had sexually communicable diseases and that there may have been a potential risk of exposure to HIV/AIDS and herpes. Instead, it argues, Duke conspired to conceal what took place and hoped that John Doe would not tell his parents what he had witnessed. To date, Duke has refused to offer any compensation whatsoever or in any way offer to make right what happened to John Doe at Camp Kaleidoscope. The claim of a cover-up appears to rest primarily on one sentence from the emails Pinella and Reed sent to Camp Kaleidoscope families on July 20th of 2017, and how you interpret it. To respect our legal and ethical requirements to safeguard patient privacy, we ask that you refrain from posting any information about the camp on social media or communication to parents or other individuals or groups. That's what the note said. In the Doe lawsuit, this line is presented as an indication that Duke had something to hide. Reed is said to have cryptically requested that the parents of campers, camp counselors, and staff of Camp Kaleidoscope not post about or otherwise communicate with the above-described events in an effort to conceal the occurrence of the same. This email was in furtherance of Duke's conspiracy to hide child sexual abuse. Duke dismisses that argument. In its responses to the first two lawsuits, the university's staff not campers' parents, despite its being addressed to Camp Kaleidoscope families. The email also says that news of the camp's closure will be communicated to the family shortly, which seems to support that claim. And that supposedly damning line, Duke's lawyers argue, doesn't allow an intent to conceal anything. Indeed, it would make sense that Duke wouldn't want staffers or even campers' family member gossiping about what happened, not merely to protect the university's reputation, but to protect the children involved, who the lawsuits allege had already suffered psychological distress. As Duke Laird lawyers put it, the email speaks for itself. Exactly what transpired inside that cabin may never be known, at least with any certainty. The only witnesses, after all, are the children themselves. But what is known, based on court documents, is unnerving. Medically complex children, as young as 7, were left unsupervised for an unknown amount of time, as Pinella admitted when the kids were taken to the hospital. During that time, some of them had sexual contact with each other, what the lawsuits describe as sexual assault. Something went wrong at a place that had done so much good for so long. As Pinella and Reed wrote in that email, "We are proud that Camp Kaleidoscope has been serving children with chronic medical conditions since 1979. In that time, we have safely and successfully cared for hundreds of children. The reevaluation of our policies and procedures will lead to an even better experience for all who attempt Camp K in the future." But only if there is a Camp K in the future, and that's not clear either. After multiple inquiries about the camp's status, Stoker, the Duke Health spokeswoman, responded Tuesday morning, saying, "We don't have anything further to provide." We turn now to the indie food section, Family Heirloom. The beauty and perils of blending different Asian cultures and cuisines in the American South. I settle into a corner table by the fig tree with a mid-morning cup of cooling tea and a Taiwanese pineapple cake. There is something so tranquil about Heirloom Brew Shop, a coffee shop, tea house, and sake bar that opened in the Dillon in Raleigh last October. From the undulating wooden ceiling and the chill electronic music to the lineup of glass teapots filled with slowly steeping leaves. Looking out the floor-to-ceiling windows across Southwest Street, I see a mural with colorful handprints and gradually transform into human silhouettes. Then a procession of people, one holding a sign that reads, "Come each of you with your colors and form fresh from dreaming." It's fitting that this mural is located across the street from Heirloom, which is owned by husband-wife team Sean Tsai and Annie Framfong. As children of Taiwanese and Laotian immigrants, respectively, who both grew up in small towns in North Carolina, one of their founding principles for Heirloom was to create a canvas that represents the full range of who they are. The space, service, menus all reflect the couple's shared Taiwanese, Japanese, and Laotian cultures. But the canvas is by no means a completed work. Rather, Heirloom is a foundation for the exploration and development of their identities as individuals, as a couple, and as a restaurant, and for the evolution of downtown Raleigh. When Heirloom was under construction, the couple introduced their concept to the public by wrapping the windows with vinyl coverings, explaining their vision and story. Tsai says that his mom, given her experience of how Asian Americans can be treated when they trumpet their heritage, at first wanted him to take the vinyl coverings down. While Tsai and Fong Fong were each navigating what it means to grow up Asian American in the 80s and 90s, Their parents were also struggling to preserve their cultures while assimilating into America. Thuram Vong grew up in High Point and Greensboro. She recalls one of the restaurants serving pizza, sub sandwiches, and Chinese food in the front, while preparing Laotian food in the back. Say, whose parents were born in a part of Taiwan where a strong Japanese influence, spent most of his childhood in Asheboro, where his family owned a restaurant that served dim sum and Taiwanese fare at a time when all Asian food was considered Chinese food. They also owned restaurants in other southern states. The initial culinary concept wasn't appreciated by most people in Asheboro, Say said. Some of the restaurants were loved and welcomed by some people, but I think the overwhelming majority of the community back then were highly resentful of us. And sometimes those hostile attitudes even became dangerous. I have been in a car with my dad when he was shot at, Say said. We have had restaurants torched before. In many respects, it is disheartening to see how little progress we've made in how we treat immigrants in this country. For despite the current political climate, and despite their parents' fears of having their children open a restaurant, Say and Thuram Vong felt there was no better time to take the plunge. We want the community to see us as people, not just as a store. Heirloom is the fabric of who we are, but we're not limited to these three cultures. It is really a mindset of to be who you are. We want staff members to be proud of who they are, and we want to nurture that and have a safe sanctuary where people can be themselves, guests or otherwise. The creation of that environment stems, in large part, from the design of the space. Both Say and Thuram Vong have backgrounds in design, too. Its focal point is the ceiling, which is an installation of individual planks of wood that was inspired by traditional Asian woodwork. It's about simple shapes creating a whole stronger than any single piece, Say explains. Given the political landscape of where we were 3 years ago, our philosophy on people and communities is that, as people, we are nothing but simple beings. But where we become strong and where we become whole is when we come together as a community. Another intentional design choice, and a more literal breaking down of barriers, is the bar. The bar itself and the pastel pink Marzocco espresso machine sit low enough to allow baristas to have eye contact with customers, and there are stools along the slow bar so customers can sit and watch the baristas prepare their coffee in a lab-like vacuum pot or wait for their tea to steep. In the evening, it's where cocktails were prepared, many of them inspired in both flavor and form from the couple's travels across Asia, particularly Japan, where presentation is paramount. When I tell Thuram Vong that a friend of mine, having noticed Heirloom, asked me, "When did Raleigh get so cool?" she smiles and pauses before responding. "It's nice to hear that it's cool," she said, "because growing up as Asian American, I wanted to assimilate to my peers so as to serve the food that we do or to prepare coffee the way that we do. It's nice to find that acceptance and hear that others are really enjoying it as well." Though Heirloom focuses a lot on drinks, food is central too. The menu is neither traditional nor fusion, but authentic in that it remains true to Say and Thuram Vong's vision. For example, you'll find Taiwanese fried chicken, but you'll also find Taiwanese fried lotus root. When cooked, lotus root's starchy texture turns meaty like a mushroom, and part of the peel, because it's crunchy coating and supremely savory flavor, is that the dish is vegan and gluten-free. It's us being authentic to ourselves and respecting different dietary needs, but also supplying traditional frying techniques. And that's where we create a new tradition in this part of Raleigh. I think people now think that fried lotus root is normal, and that's how tradition starts. Then there's no rule as to what is tradition and what's not. A braised pork dish the couple is working on serve as a reminder that Say and Flom Fong are still learning the nuances of each other's cultures and how to create something that honors them both. In Laos, the dish is called Tom Kim, and the pork is first pan-fried in fish sauce and caramelized sugar to strike the salty-sweet balance characteristic of Laotian cuisine. The Taiwanese version that Say grew up eating, lo ba, which translates to stewed meat, is seasoned with vinegar, mirin, soy sauce, and Chinese five spice, creating a sharper flavor. During our interviews, my eyes wander to the shelves near the entrance, lined with dried flowers, jars of honey, boxes of tea, and bottles of sake, and I notice the small golden Buddha statue in the corner. There are cups of water, too, which Fong Fong explains are offerings. Prior to Heirloom's opening, the couple invited a monk to perform a blessing ceremony to not only offer protection, warmth, and good luck, but also to pay respect to the building's heritage. The monk did say that there was a spirit here who isn't happy with the change of the entire building itself. So when we do the offering, we're offering to the Buddha and also the spirit itself for allowing us to be here because it's not our space to begin with. A few weeks after the ceremony, a rabbi stopped by inquiring about using heirloom for a menorah lighting that he was planning, saying he felt it was a place that would respect his culture. That place was, they opened the clearing space at the far end of the restaurant and brought in the kosher food. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder that this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So, until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.